You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of towns are full of forgotten, tucked away rooms that have been lost to history. We'll learn about a few of those hidden, sometimes secret spaces in Eau Claire.
First, if you're looking to settle a grievance with your financial institution, taking it to court may be off the table. Last night, the United States Senate moved to block new regulations that would have allowed consumers to join class action lawsuits to sue their bank or credit card companies to resolve financial disputes as opposed to settling them in arbitration.
After a 50-50 vote count, Vice President Mike Pence cast the deciding vote in favor of ending that rule, which initially came from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Renee Merle joins us now. She's a financial reporter for The Washington Post covering Wall Street and white-collar crime. Renee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Renee, what was the decision coming out of the Senate yesterday?
The Senate basically decided to block regulations that had been approved by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. The CFPB had studied the issue of arbitration clauses. This is like the fine print that you agree to when you sign up for a credit card or open a bank account. This says that if you have a problem with your bank, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, whoever, that you're not going to sue them. You're not going to go join a class action suit. You're going to figure it out through arbitration. And the CFPB has said that actually these forced arbitration clauses, you know, we don't want them to be as widely used. They were going to basically block the use of those kinds of that kind of language and make it possible for consumers to sue their financial institution if they wanted to.
Go ahead.
I say, obviously, banks and the Republicans didn't like this, and so they got together. Republicans last night voted to block the CFPB from implementing that rule.
And the Senate was deadlocked on this, meaning the vice president had to cast a deciding vote. What can you tell us about how those votes lined up?
It was largely along partisan lines. There were two Republicans who broke ranks. Senator Lindsey Graham, who has long supported the use of class action lawsuits. He's just always been an outlier as a Republican on this issue. And then Senator Kennedy as well from Louisiana broke ranks. It's unclear to me why he broke ranks particularly, but two Republicans broke ranks, so that left it at 50-50, and that's why Vice President Pence was called in to break the tie.
Can you talk us through what advocates of the rule had to say and what critics had to say?
So on the side of the advocates, on the side of the CFPB, the argument was that you're signing away your rights to sue without even knowing it. It's in the fine print of all of these agreements. Nobody looks at it. And in some cases, the arbitration process isn't fair. It's not going to, the arbitration is usually paid for and set up by the bank so that perhaps that they have more control about how this all plays out and how it happens. And so, you know, in some cases, they're saying a class action lawsuit will bring more publicity to whatever issue that you found and allow a lot of people to band together to go after a bank for bad practices. On the other side of the argument are these banks who say, look, it's, you know, arbitration is faster, cheaper for all of us. Going through the court system is really expensive and time consuming. And in a lot of cases, what the consumer and the bank are fighting over is perhaps $30 or $40. Nobody wants to go to court for that. So let's just figure this out through arbitration. No reason to get a bunch of lawyers involved. They say that, you know, that allowing class action lawsuits is great for trial attorneys, but not for consumers.
We're talking to Renee Merle right now, financial reporter for The Washington Post, looking at Senate regulations, why the Senate blocked new regulations that would have made it easier for consumers to sue their bank or credit card company to resolve financial disputes. And it sounds as though some of the debate around this drew in consumer sentiment around Equifax and Wells Fargo, both of which have been in the news for bad reasons for those companies, are dealing with some pushback from consumers there. How did that aspect play out?
Well, definitely. Both Wells Fargo and Equifax, of course, are persona non grata right now. Big financial institutions that have been blamed for doing a lot of things wrong to consumers. And so Democrats and consumer advocates have really latched on to these companies and said that supporting a repeal of the arbitration rule, going against the CFPB, was in essence being for Wells Fargo and Equifax, that you would be giving these two companies a get-out-of-jail-free card, that since consumers wouldn't be able to sue them as easily, that you were basically siding with these big financial institutions, you're siding with big banks. And so it you know, became just a way to clarify the issue publicly for Democrats and for some of these consumer groups. There was one advocate, Amanda Werner, who actually dressed up as a Monopoly character for the Monopoly board game and would sit during congressional hearings and try to get into camera range. She's, you know, had on a black top hat, white mustache, a monocle, and she's like waving around big fake money and trying to get people's attention and saying, hey, don't let, you know, this arbitration issue just go by the wayside. So the Democrats and these progressive groups are really trying to use the public's anger at Equifax and Wells Fargo and use that to galvanize support for the CFPB rule.
Renee, what recourse do consumers have left with this option off the table?
Well, you have a status quo. In most of the cases, that you're going to have no option but to go through arbitration and kind of hope that you get somebody, a good arbiter. A lot of times the arbitration usually is paid for by the bank, and there might be a cap on how much you can recover, and then sometimes it's kept private, kept secret. And so, but it all depends on what your contract says. You have to literally read the fine print of those things. In some cases, it does require arbitration. Sometimes it says first arbitration, and if you don't like the result, then perhaps you can go to small claims court, but you still can't, you know, file a class action lawsuit. So it really depends on what your contract with these institutions says, but it could be anything from arbitration or nothing to perhaps small claims court, or maybe there's a small loophole, though I haven't heard of any that would let you join a class action lawsuit. But in most cases, you're going to be kept to arbitration.
Do you see any other financial regulations looking at another pass through Congress, maybe being rolled back in the coming months?
Oh, for sure. If Congress is able to get through tax reform and, you know, lowering the tax rate, that was just obviously a big priority of President Trump, if they're able to get through that by the end of this year, which I'm not sure they will, but if they do, then I think that early 2018 we'll see a big push towards loosening a lot of the regulations that were put on the financial sector after the financial crisis in 2008. The House has already passed some legislation that that Wall Street has asked for in this area, but the Senate has yet to take it up. But once tax reform clears, and as long as health care and Obamacare doesn't come back up, I wouldn't be surprised at all if we spent several months going through efforts to deregulate some of these big banks.
Renee, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Renee Merle is a financial reporter for The Washington Post, covering Wall Street and white-collar crime, joining us to look at why the Senate blocked new regulations that would have made it easier for consumers to sue their bank account or credit card company to resolve financial disputes. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
When a book has been loved to death, sometimes it needs to be brought to someone who can bring it back to life. WXPR's Mackenzie Martin has the story of a Northwoods bookbinder.
Florin Bieschke's bookbindery, Atelier, is situated in the middle of the woods in Arborvita. Inside, it's small, just enough room for four people to be working on books at once.
This one is about Antonio Stradivari, violin builder. It's a limited edition, and what makes it rare is that this is number two. The Stradivari family owns number one.
Working from photos he has of other copies of the book, Florian plans to preserve its original cover but redo the spine. He says it'll look 90% original.
Because you will see where the old meets the new.
Florian says that he has always been artistic, but has never been one to limit himself to one specialty.
In just doing a book, there's so much of everything to do, and I enjoy every task.
Every task?
Every single task. The mundane stuff is when I relax. When it's time to sew a book, put on my favorite music, sit down, and sew.
His favorite music, by the way, Gregorian chants. It was during a period where Florian was focusing on other artistic passions that he saw the very bindery equipment that he uses today, chained up outside of a store. He had previously owned a bindery somewhere else, and since he knew what the equipment was worth, he bought it without any real plan in mind.
I'm a notorious collector, okay? If I see something that I know is valuable and I think that no one else will recognize its value and it will pass into obscurity unless I charge in on my white horse and save it, I do invariably do just that.
He had the equipment for 10 years before he opened up Atelier. Similarly, he'd been interested in the craft of repairing books since he was a kid. It all started when his Catholic grade school had a book fair and he was walking home from school with a new purchase.
And my neighbor friend, it was wintertime, he had an ice ball. And I'm walking along and this guy nails me with that thing, knocked me off my feet, and I dropped my book and split the spine. And I looked at that as a little kid and you're seeing torn paper, broken binding, and my thought was, I'm going to learn to fix that one day. That's when the seed was planted, that books are so fragile if they're mistreated, and you got to know how to take care of them.
When he isn't working on rare books like the Antonio Stradivari book, he's often spending his time restoring worthless books. Books that aren't inherently valuable or rare, but to someone somewhere, they are priceless.
I'm happy with my efforts. I'm really glad. I don't care what it is, if it's some silly book of poetry that I could buy for 50 cents down the street, but it has that customer's grandmother's signature on it, and we were able to save that and put that together for them again, that's great.
Why is that great? Why does it make you feel so fulfilled?
We were part of humanity. You're part of that person's life now. You touched something that means something to them. You had it for a while. They entrusted it to you. I mean, you're telling them, I'm going to take this all apart and put it all back together again.
And although Florian has many passions, there's one thing he knows he could never do.
I couldn't be a bookseller.
Because you like them too much?
Yeah, I wouldn't sell anything.
That story was produced by WXPR's Mackenzie Martin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, most towns are full of forgotten, tucked away rooms or places that have been lost to history. And our next guest is here to tell us about some of these hidden, sometimes secret spaces in the city of Eau Claire.
Mike Paulus joins us now. He's the online editor at Volume 1, and you can find his recent article on this and all the cool photos linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well,
Happy October.
You too. You wrote this article, Secret Spaces, a lot of great photos, but what inspired you to start digging into some of these old spaces that most people don't even know they're there?
Well, that all came down to our photographer, Tina Ecker. She's kind of made a name for herself in local photography groups as somebody who gets out there and takes great pictures of local parks and historical buildings. And she started getting access to some of these cool old spaces. And seeing her work online, we just thought that would be a great photo essay for the magazine.
Let's talk about some of the spaces and rooms and houses that you feature. One of them you label pretend houses. They look like houses, but it turns out they're not. What are they?
Well, honestly, this is probably my favorite one because it's got a very Stranger Things kind of vibe to it, and that a government entity is kind of concealing itself in plain sight, though for much less nefarious reasons. But around the city of Eau Claire, there are five of these very plain-looking houses, and the city of Eau Claire just kind of quietly mows the lawn and trims the hedges and tries to keep them as plain-looking as possible, and they just look like these boring old ranch houses from the late 70s and 80s. But if you were to go inside one, it doesn't look like a house at all. There's a giant room inside. It's one room, and it's full of pipes and machinery, because these are actually water pump stations that keep water moving throughout the city of Eau Claire.
And this is something that most people will never see the inside of, and probably most people will walk or drive by and have no idea.
Yeah, and that's kind of the cool part of all of these spaces, is that they're right on the other side of these walls that we see every day, and we don't even think about them.
And churches seem like they hold secrets a lot of the time, especially historic buildings, churches that have been around for a while. Tell us about one or two of your favorites.
Well, probably my very favorite one is it's in a section of the feature I called Under the Chapel, and that's the Hoover Memorial Chapel. And it's very near and dear to my heart because I got married there 13 years ago this week.
Ah, congrats.
Oh, thank you. And I drive by it every day as I drive my daughter to school, and it's something that you just don't think about. But when I was saying my wedding vows to my wife, I was actually standing over one of these secret spaces. So if you go into the Hoover Memorial Chapel in Eau Claire, in the red tile floor, there's a big rectangle in the floor, and that's actually the top of an elevator. And so if you go down in the underneath the chapel, there's this big old hand-cranked elevator where that section of floor lowers in to this space, and it's actually a mortuary where there's 42 well-ventilated vaults lining each wall, and that's where they used to inter the deceased before a funeral service.
Yeah, the picture of that one was something else. You did not expect to see that there.
No, and the hand-cranked elevator that used to bring the caskets up and down still works and everything. It's pretty cool to see.
So used to. This is still not used, I guess not used for anything now?
It's used for storage for the church that maintains the chapel. But it's just a beautiful chapel right next to a cemetery, and you wouldn't even know it's underneath it.
You feature another building where it used to be used as more up high instead of down low, and it used to be for pumpkins, I think you said, and squash over the winter in maids' quarters, and no one would have known that it was there.
Right. We call this one the Old Attic, and this is the attic of the Schmegelmilch House, which is a historic building right in the center of downtown Eau Claire. And this building was built the part that we see now was built in 1871, and it replaced an older structure. And the Schmegelmilch family lived there for years and kept their gourds and everything that they harvested in the fall up in the attic. And there were maid quarters up there, too. And the pictures are kind of nice because it's kind of got a creepy attic vibe. But a really cool thing about that is that right at the top of the stairs, as you enter the attic, there's a little room that they had built, and it's actually built out of the wood from old shipping containers used in the Schmegelmilch hardware store. So there's some kind of like historical quirky things going on up in that attic as well.
You know, Mike, before we visit a couple other sites, does doing this make you, when you go into an old building now, wonder what's here? And can I go into the basement and look around or the attic?
Oh, always. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because there's just small sections of buildings that just don't really make sense anymore in our modern world, but they're there tucked away, and they're either unused or we've given them a new purpose because their original purpose just kind of slipped away over time.
And some of it it's poignant because it's abandoned, but it still looks like it could be used. The one that kind of got me was this abandoned auditorium in a former school, and you could just imagine the students filling it up and coming for their first days of school, beginning their days, and it just sits there, it sounds like.
Yeah, the auditorium in the old Eau Claire High School, which is now used, part of that building is used for our administration now for the school district, but yeah, the auditorium is definitely not used for anything, and when you see the rows and rows of those old wooden seats there, you can really kind of feel the energy of all the, you know, kids and all the hormones that kind of passed through that room over the years, and now it's just empty, and it's got these big, beautiful walls with this kind of nice scroll work that no one gets to see anymore.
You also looked at an industrial site, Eau Claire, like a lot of places in Wisconsin, has some paper industry history. And what did you find at what was formerly the Eau Claire Pulp and Paper Company?
Oh, yeah. That original building of that mill, which is now the Cascades Tissue Complex, that was built in 1883 on the banks of the Chippewa River. And down in the basement of the original building, they still have machinery that they still use down there. But the pictures we got are just fantastic because they kind of look like they're from a horror movie almost. The original thick brick walls down in the basement that you know have just been there for over 100 years, and the big archways for the doorways. And so there's still machinery, and there's still workers that get to go down there every day. But I wouldn't want to go down there on my own, I don't think.
That reminds me, I was in Beloit a while back, and I got to tour some abandoned factories. They're in the midst of being turned into an enterprise center, but I got to wander around just empty abandoned factory. It made me feel like I was in, you know, The Walking Dead. This everybody's gone. Maybe the zombies are around the corner. I don't know. It can be creepy to go into these places sometimes.
Yeah, and that's kind of part of the fun. I mean, that's why we were running this feature in October, all places. And Tina, who took our photos, she's definitely into things that kind of have a spooky tinge to them, too. She's really good at capturing that.
So now that you've run this, are people coming up to you and saying, I've got a building for you with a hidden space, you need to check it out?
Yes, we've had plenty of recommendations of places. And there are plenty of people around who still remember some of these rooms when they were actually in use, and they were actually kind of reminiscing with each other online in our comments section.
That's interesting. This is giving a window not just into cool and interesting places, but to some of the city of the history of the city that people might have forgotten.
Oh, yeah. And there's things that are forgotten and just things that were never known by people, like the projector room in the State Theater.
Oh, yeah.
Our beloved State Theater, people don't realize that was originally a cinema, you know, a movie house, not a traditional theater. And up in the back of the balcony, the projector room is still there, and the hulking old projectors with a very steampunk kind of feel are still in there to this day.
Are there any places that you know about, you got wind of, but you just couldn't get access to?
Oh, boy. Well, our city hall is being renovated right now, and I know that our photographer, Tina, has been in there and documenting that for the city, but I'm not sure we were able to get access to use those pictures for things, but it's a beautiful old building, and I'm so glad they're restoring it. I think it'll be on display now. But, yeah, there's definitely some kind of shadowy nooks and crannies in City Hall that would have been fun to explore.
I'll look forward to the next one. Mike, thanks a lot.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Mike Paulus is the online editor at Volume 1. We've been talking about his recent article that looked at hidden places in the city of Eau Claire. And you can find that article and all the great photos of those spaces linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, do you want to be happier, healthier, to be a better person than you currently are? There's a good chance you'd say yes to, I don't know, at least one of those questions.
Our next guest says there's good news. There are decades of psychological research that can help us make positive changes in our daily lives, but you don't have to read thousands of academic journals to figure out how to do it.
Regan Gruing joins us now to tell us how to get psyched. He's the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at UW Green Bay. He did a TEDx talk called Get Psyched, Think Stronger, Live Longer. Regan, good to have you back.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
Let's start with
Veronica.
Let's start with a really small question, Regan. Why do we think, believe, and behave the way that we do?
Wow, that's a small question, isn't it, Rob? Yeah. Well, you know, the good news is I do have a short answer. And let me preface it by saying this is a short answer that comes from about 20-plus years of teaching and doing research in psychology. And the short answer is that it really boils down to our biology and what we already have, and you got to be aware of that. It boils down to how we've learned to do the things that we do, and it boils down to our social networks. So we really think, feel, behave because of the biology we have, our learned experiences, and our social networks. And, you know, we can unpack that, but that's the short answer.
So by the time you get to a particular age, it seems like that stuff has been imprinted on us and that our behavior is in this track and we're going to keep rolling down that track no matter what. But can we actually change ourselves?
So the good news is yes. The bad news is it takes some work, but, you know, few good things come easily. One of my favorite lines from The Princess Bride is, life is pain, princess, and anybody who tells you anything otherwise is trying to sell you something. So,
that's a good line.
Yeah. So you can change things. You can change things. But what you said about imprinting, we now know that the age that you're talking about is very different. So if you have a four-year-old or a five-year-old, that's exactly where they're developing their food preferences, for example. If you have a 10-year-old or 11-year-old, that's the key times where they're developing habits about exercising and eating well and drinking well. Now, by the time you get to 18 or 19, a lot of those experiences are already automatic. By the time you get beyond that, they are even more firmly entrenched and you've got into a routine or a habit of doing them. That's why one of the key things is to realize that some of your thoughts and some of your reactions are automatic. I mean, that's important. They are automatic. It's going to happen. But you've got to be able to see them, recognize that they're automatic, and then make some changes.
Right, and you've got kind of a three-point plan that we're going to get to in a minute, but it seems like that's a tall order. Once we're sort of locked into these patterns of behavior and these automatic responses, how do we, I guess, step outside of ourselves and treat ourselves as psychological subjects so we can understand ourselves to start making changes?
And I think the key word in that question is understand. And I think we've got to understand the sources of our feelings and behaviors. I think most of us don't realize that how much of what we do is biologically based. And let me, there are two key fascinating things here. When I say biologically based, our neurons and in our brain, they are firing millions of times. I mean, in the last 5 minutes that we've been talking, our neurons, yours and mine and our listeners, have fired probably millions of times. Now, the crazy thing is, by the time we are conscious of something, our brains have already done a lot of work. So it's that proverbial tip of the iceberg. When I have a conscious thought, I may go, I'm so conscious, I'm so in charge of myself. But the reality is that conscious thought I've had is the result of a lifetime of biology and reactions that are all taking place non-consciously. So to go back to that key word in your question, it's we've got to understand that a lot of the ways we think are automatic, that a lot of the ways we think and feel are biological in nature. And the moment we understand that, I think it puts us in a position to do something more about it versus sitting back and going, oh, that's who I am.
We're talking to Regan Gurung right now from the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and he's sharing ways that we can use psychological research to improve our lives. And let's get into your plan, Regan. You've got a three-point plan to address what you're talking about here, and it is chill, drill, and build. Let's start with chill. What is that one?
So as far as chilling goes, and that's one of those things where it reminds us that when we feel agitated or whenever we experience something, there's a lot of biology going on. I'm a stress researcher. I've studied stress a lot. Whenever we get stressed, our bodies are releasing or pumping our system full of catecholamines and endorphins and epinephrine and norepinephrine, a whole bunch of chemicals. And all those chemicals are circulating through our bodies when we are stressed. When I say one of the first things we should do is chill, is literally, I mean, pull yourself away from those situations that are causing you aggravation. This could be a heated discussion or debate. This could be, a fight that you're having. This could be somebody who's making you angry. Move away from that, because when we chill or take some time out, it gives those circulating chemicals in our body some time to subside. So one of the first steps is that actually pulling back. And the classic example comes from anger. For the longest time, and I can remember when I was first teaching introductory psychology, one of the first things that surprised many, many folks is that instead of throwing punches or breaking plates or doing something like that when you're angry, research has shown that actually just pulling back and being quiet and moving away from everything actually does better for your anger, because your anger then subsides. So the whole, boy, I feel like punching something, well, that's actually not a good idea. That could aggravate you more. So instead, chill, pull away from the situation. That lets your brain, your blood pressure go down. It lets those circulating chemicals go down.
So if we have a habit, say a certain situation, whether it's, driving or arguing with someone or whatever, that sets us off and we know we're not our best self in that moment, how do we start to train ourselves to chill, to take that minute before that initial response that's just going to make things worse.
So, interestingly enough, sometimes the chill is great for where or when you're already in that situation. When it comes to how do we actually prevent situations, that's, I think, where my second thought of drilling comes in. I think it's practicing anticipating situations and then practicing the actual thoughts you will make yourself think when that situation comes up. So when I say drill, I mean we've got to practice over and over again. We've got to practice thinking differently. We've got to be able to recognize that automatic thought that pops into our head and in the anger situation, you know, oh, here's that person doing that thing again, right? We've got to recognize that automatic thought. We've just got to practice a different behavior or thought that we can substitute. And that's why the drilling is so important, because many of our reactions, yours, mine, by the time you're, gosh, 18, let alone 12, 13 or older, but even by 12 or 13, you've got these automatic thoughts. And we've got to practice literally changing how we think about situations. And that does take practice. It takes that drilling over and over and over again. So before you get into a situation with somebody that could make you angry, you've got to, if you know, oh, you know what? The last time I spoke to this person or this kind of situation makes me angry, you practice a priori beforehand what will you think would do if that situation gets there. And it's that practice over and over that actually changes the old habits that you have for new habits and healthier ones.
I want to ask you about the chilling aspect of what you were saying again. My grandparents always used to say, don't go to bed angry. But, you know, there were times in my life when I thought, but I'm mad. And then if I waited till the next morning, then I wouldn't be. So were they wrong?
So I think your grandparents tap into another very interesting way of coping. And when we cope, one of the successful ways of coping is technically referred to as emotional expression. But it's really what your grandparents say, which is talk about it. Now, that talking about it works for most people, for many people. But there are some of us who actually just need some time. And the reality is, depending on how angry you are it's better to let that person take some time to themselves and then talk to them versus pushing them to talk. And I think there's where that balance comes in. There's no doubt that expressing your emotions and talking about something, there's no doubt that that helps. But it's all timing. So it's always chill first. Make sure that that person is ready to talk, is ready to get into the issues, and then you're going to be much more successful.
And then with drilling, you've talked about practicing to avoid relying on stereotypes of other people based on a lot of different factors. How does that work?
Oh, absolutely. I think as a social psychologist, one of the first few things I studied was stereotyping. And by definition, stereotyping is when we have this general sense of a whole group of people or event. And we see an example of that group and we assume everybody's like that. So, you know, one of the things I talked about even in the TED Talk is whenever people run into me and I'm Indian or Indian American and they will say to me, oh, what sort of doctor are you? And, you know, that's a stereotype. Yes, indeed. A lot of Indians are doctors, but not all of us are. So stereotypes from a human being standpoint, stereotypes really help us save time. They really help us save time. Stereotypes often are true, but they're not true all the time. And the way I like to think about it is a stereotype is a great mental shortcut, but we can't just stop at the shortcut. We've got to go, okay, this sort of gives me a sense of what to expect, what this person may be, but we shouldn't assume that the stereotype is true of every individual in that group. And I think, unfortunately, we see too much of that where we will run into somebody different. We will run into somebody who's a member of a certain group and assume that they hold all the stereotypes of that group when that is not necessarily the case.
We're talking to psychology professor Regan Gurung from UW Green Bay. He's sharing ways we can use psychological research to improve our lives.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this chill, drill, and build idea? Do you have something like that in your daily life that works for you? Do you have a question for our guest about how to apply this in your own life? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're learning how to use psychological science to improve our daily lives. Regan Gurung is with us. He's a psychology professor at UW Green Bay.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you figured out something about yourself? Maybe something that you didn't like and tried to tackle it, tried to change it? What worked? What didn't work for you? Did you maybe break a habit, get out of that initial angry or stressed response to certain situations? Or do you have questions about how to do that? Call 800-642-1234.
And Regan, let's talk more about social connections and why they matter. What do you think the benefits are?
So I think when I look around at the psychological literature on what seems to be helping the most, one thing that pops up over and over and over is social support. So social support, the feeling that you're cared for or esteemed, is one of those buffers and protective features that I think across the board helps us feel better. And that's why the third part of the chill, drill, and build is actually us building our support networks. What's fascinating is that it's both how much social support we perceive to have, but all, and how much we actually have that makes a difference. And I think what I want to highlight is it just doesn't, it's not even what you actually get, but even you believing that you have people to turn to when you need it is this buffer that makes us feel better. So that's why I say build those networks, cultivate those good networks, let your friends know you care about them, keep in touch with people, because that is something that when need be can be that protective buffer that can help us a lot.
I want to bring on a caller now. We've got Jim on the line in Waukesha. Jim, hi.
Hello. Let me get this off speaker. Okay, thank you. This is really interesting to me, and I was wondering, do you see this as a tool somebody, an addictive person, could use to help them move away from the urges that come along when, say, they run into that point where they're getting antsy and wanting to fall into bad behaviors?
So, Jim, absolutely. I think especially the drill part is a major component of behavior change. So I do a lot of work in health psychology, and I'm actually teaching a health psychology class right now, and all my students have to pick a behavior that they want to change. And what we do is, what we prepare for is those thoughts that are automatic that come up. And you mentioned the word when you get antsy, and that's exactly it. When you get antsy, when you experience that antsiness, what are you going to say to yourself? What are you going to do? And if you prepare those things that you can do when you get antsy, and if you practice, if you drill those things, when you do get antsy, you'll be able to head it off at the pass. So if you're trying to keep away from snacks and you feel that urge for snacks coming, you should have a plan in place. The next time you feel like a snack, what are you going to say to yourself? What are you going to do? And if you practice that thought enough, when you have that thought, you have something to defend against it.
I want to highlight another question from a caller who couldn't stay on the line. I think it's kind of universal for most people in their life. She says she was let down by some friends, got past the anger, but how does she stop replaying it in her head to fully walk away from it?
So there's something else here that we didn't talk about. And when we talk about drilling, one of the things that we have to drill is, and this may help in this situation, is when any time we experience something, we also have automatic reasons that we tell ourselves why something happened. And we've got to practice thinking of those other reasons that it could be. And I think, you know, I'll give you a simple example. I'm walking down the sidewalk and I pass a friend, and the friend looks right past me. And I go, oh my, what did I do to hurt that person? And later on, I talk to that friend and they go, I pass and I say, hey, how come you didn't even look at me? You know, that felt bad. I was hurt. And they go, look at you. I didn't even see you. When did I see you? See, and if I had thought that it could be something else, it would have been different. So we have many of these kinds of automatic thoughts, and especially with our friends, when our friends do something, we often have an automatic thought of what we think it means. And I think we've got to practice coming up with other possible explanations.
Regan Gruing is with us, psychologist at UW Green Bay. He is harnessing the power of psychological research to help us improve our lives. We'll go back to your calls now. Lynn is on the line in Onalaska. Lynn, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to tell us about, Lynn?
Well, when I was a young child, I was about a year old, my mom told me that I used to hold my breath. My baby sister was born, and it was my way of getting attention, so I would literally pass out.
Wow.
And 50 years later, I find that when I'm in very stressful, anxious situations, I'm breathing very shallowly. And my way of combating that was about 10 years ago, I started going to yoga. And yoga is stretching and breathing. And when I find myself in those situations, I'm more aware now. And I just stop myself and I start breathing. And I seem to be able to get past that.
Lynn, thanks for the call. So she's aware, Regan, of the physical symptoms of her stress, and then she's taken this yoga class to help deal with that.
What a great example of drilling. I mean, you've practiced that alternate strategy, and it's working.
Lynn, thanks a lot for that, and we'll go next to David in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, quick question. You were talking earlier about backing down, pulling back from the anger and the different ways to approach that, and that's kind of what we're talking about now, I guess, and about how the different chemicals are released physically in our body when we escalate, when the anger comes. And sometimes I feel like we walk around with a lot of anger that we don't express and or don't back down from. And I was just curious, do you find is the approach best to just try to become more pacifist, to just create these tools to back down from the anger? Or is it also healthy to find healthy ways to express the anger? Is it important to get the anger out in some healthy way?
So here's an interesting thing to do that you may not have thought about, but when you started at a really key place, David, which is we're walking around with a lot of those anger chemicals, or stress, anger, both of these release a lot of neurochemicals in our brain. Interestingly enough, from an evolutionary standpoint, or when you think about why do we do that? Why does our body do that? We can use the answer to that question to tell us what to do. So our body does that to help us prepare to deal with somebody attacking us. Our body does that to make us deal with this physical stressor. In our world today, we don't have that many physical stressors. We've got mental stressors, but the solution is actually still physical. So something that I do myself and recommend is get more physical activity. If you walk faster, go for a jog, go for a run, step on the treadmill, what your body is doing is actually using up those circulating neurochemicals that will then help you feel better.
Good luck, David. Hope that helps. And Regan, briefly, as we wrap up, how can we get started after we're done talking here?
I think the first step is catch yourself. When you think something automatically, recognize those automatic thoughts and say, all right, the next time that happens, I'm going to recognize that it's automatic. It doesn't have to be that way.
Sounds good. Sounds like something we can start without too much trouble. How long should we take? How long will it take us to get good at this, Regan?
It depends on how hard you work at it, right? Just do it. Practice the drill. Do it often. You'd be surprised how quickly it'll help.
No, that's good to hear. All right. Well, Regan, thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you.
We're talking there to Regan Gruing, professor of human development and psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, talking about how we can use psychological science to make our lives better and to make real and lasting changes in ourselves.